And a very good afternoon to you. Barry Redfern here, standing in for Andy Wint, who's still under the weather. So if you're listening, Andy, do get well soon. Today, I suspect me may well have a very busy man in line. Our guest is David Ashford, MHK, MBE, who represents Douglas North, but of course probably better known as the former Treasury Minister and Minister for Health and Social Care. So we await your call on 66 1368, and you can also text us on 166 177, and emails to studio@manxradio.com. So, David Ashford, welcome to the Man in Line.
Good afternoon, Barry.
Well, it's been a long time since you were last here, hasn't it? A lot's happened in the meantime.
There's been an awful lot going on. I don't know how long it's been, actually. I think maybe a couple of months since I was last on with Andy, but certainly a lot's changed since then.
Let's go back to the Dr. Rosalind Ranson inquiry. It was a tough time. You said you weren't going to resign, and then you did. What happened?
Well, I've got to be very careful what I say around the inquiry because it hasn't concluded yet. There's still direction hearings to be held, so I've got to be very careful I don't say anything that would put me in contempt of the Employment Tribunal. Mm. So while I can talk about the themes around it, I can't necessarily talk about the Tribunal itself. Yeah. So in terms of the actual timeline, basically the report came out, I think it was a Wednesday afternoon. Manx Radio asked me on the Thursday, was I planning on resigning? At that point, I wasn't. I read the report over the Thursday and the Friday because it was about 200 pages of report to read. And I basically came to the conclusion on the Saturday that I felt it would be appropriate, since I was Minister of the Department at the time, to offer my resignation to the Chief Minister, which I then did at the first opportunity on the Monday following. The Chief Minister asked me to go away and reconsider, and I said I would reconsider up to that Friday, but I would be unlikely to change my mind. I didn't change my mind, and on the Friday I resigned.
Wasn't pleasant reading, was it? A few people were criticised.
Well, what I've got to say is, as I say, the minister is not involved in any of the decisions around employment matters.
No, but you must have known what was going on, though. Sure.
Again, I've got to be careful what I say. I can speak a lot more about this once the sub judice is lifted. There was an awful lot in there that was actually news to me, and I'll speak more in detail about that once the tribunal is fully concluded. But what I would say, and I can speak on the more broader themes, is one of the things the report absolutely shows is that culture around government needs to radically change. That's something that when I was Minister for Health, I mentioned in Tim Ward numerous times that the culture within government actually needed to be changed. It was one of the reasons that myself and the then Treasury Minister, now Chief Minister, commissioned the Sir Jonathan Michael Review. And it actually merited an entire section within that review saying that the culture within health and social care needed to change. There has been a lot of work done across the board since then, but obviously something like this has still happened.
And well, it's all right saying that now, but why weren't you doing something at the time to change the environment?
Well, actually, we were, and there was an awful lot of work going on within the department and within Manx Care itself to actually try and change the culture. But as I made clear and Tim Ward quite a while ago, it wasn't going to be something that was going to change overnight. I made clear in my resignation statement to the House of Keys that if people think you just change a few people at the top and that deals with culture, they're going to be sorely disappointed, because culture runs the whole way through an organisation like a river. You don't just change at one level, you've got to change the whole way down, and that takes a substantial period of time. And in fact, my time as minister is a prime example of that, because during my 4 years as Minister for Health, the entire management team at the Department of Health changed. There wasn't a single member of the management team left when I left office that was there when I started. And yet we still had an incident like this.
Looking at the inquiry and all the names mentioned, do forgive me, but I get the impression that there are rather a lot of chiefs involved.
Well, were involved. Well, there's various references to various people. And like I say, I've got to be very careful what I say because there's still proceedings ongoing in the tribunal. There are some people that obviously don't come out of the report very, very well as it currently stands. And like I say, I'll be able to say more about that once the inquiry concludes.
When will that be?
We don't know. It's entirely up to the tribunal. They've got direction hearings, I believe, booked in for August. But once proceedings are fully done, then obviously I can speak more on that.
But let's just go back to the people involved, because Megson was... she wasn't here, was she?
No, she wasn't for a period of it. But to be honest, I've got to say I don't believe it interfered with the ability to do the job.
Really?
I actually still stand by the fact that I think it is a job that was able to be done remotely. It was a job that was actually done remotely, and I think that was appropriate.
How can you have a health chief who's only working 3 days a week from the UK?
First of all, she wasn't working 3 days a week. I need to correct that. She was working full time.
Yes.
The arrangement was 3 days on Ireland.
But she was employed.
2 days
she
off.
Was employed by the UK NHS at the time.
She was seconded to the Isle of Man. So she was employed full time by the Isle of Man. She was working full time for the Department of Health. So I do need to be clear, the 3 days, which you mentioned there, Barry, that comes from the arrangement pre-COVID and after COVID, where she did 3 days on Ireland and 2 days off Ireland. But she was employed full-time and worked 5 days a week.
Is that going to be the same arrangement for the new person?
Well, that's not up to me. It depends who comes forward. Every single interview process is done individually.
You mean it'll be up to the candidates?
Well, no, it won't be up to the candidates. It'll be up to the interview panel.
But you would seriously consider someone working away remotely, not on Ireland, someone in a top position?
If they can prove that they can still do the job, and in this day and age, with the way technology is now, working remotely is actually more and more viable. You are seeing it across some of the big companies now internationally as well, where people are even in different jurisdictions to where they actually are working. And you are going to see that more and more, I think, as things move forward, particularly if you're going to get the actual top-notch candidates. You are sometimes going to have to compromise around working conditions, and we are starting to see that more and more coming through.
But going back to that earlier comment about the responsibilities and the number of people involved, why do we have someone in that position who may well not be a medical professional?
Because they don't need to be a medical professional to be CEO of the department. To be CEO, you've got to remember the department is not actually involved in day-to-day medical operational issues. The role of the CEO of the department, even more so now we've got the split with Manx Care, which deals entirely with operational side, is to actually manage the department, which deals with policy and strategy. They are not a medic. They do not involve themselves in medical decisions. They are purely there to manage the department and also ensure that the policy and strategy is flowing correctly.
But don't you really need someone with some amount of medical knowledge when you're putting them between the government and the medical fraternity?
Well, no, because there is still the lines of flow through public health. There is a medical director in place. There is also the various medical committees. I think one of the things that would actually cause a logjam in Department of Health and Social Care, having been minister there for 4 years, is if you had a CEO who was medically qualified and was trying to interfere in medical decisions. I think that would cause an absolute logjam and chaos within DHSC.
OK, well, we'll just take a break from that issue just for a moment. And let's go to the lines now. And we've got Betty on line one, I think. Hello. Good afternoon, Betty.
Hi. Yes, I hope you're feeling well.
I'm absolutely fine, Betty. How are you?
I'm OK. David, I haven't met you and I have nothing to do with you. Apart from being a member of the community generally. So I just want to say this. I have spoken to you online a few times, and I have always found you to be somebody who listens and a very decent person and willing to try and help. And that's all I want to say, really.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You've got a friend for life there, David.
Oh, well, thank you, Betty. Thank you very much. That's much appreciated.
Well, I know things haven't been easy for you at the moment, and I just think you need to have somebody who is willing to stand up for you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Betty. I'm sure David really appreciates your comments. Okay. Thanks, Betty. Cheers. And that really is a good point Betty made there, that it's not always easy for politicians, is it? I mean, we're very quick to blame them when something goes wrong, but we don't say thank you.
It's not easy, but it's the type of job you know you're taking on. When you're a politician, you are effectively, particularly if you're a minister, you are in charge of the department, you're the public face of the department, and you know you have to take responsibility for things, even if sometimes you're not directly responsible for the outcome. That's what comes with political accountability. You're elected to represent the people. You know, when things go right, politicians are always very quick to actually come forward and sometimes take the credit and actually say, this has gone right. And equally, when things go wrong, politicians have to take it on the chin and do the appropriate thing.
Did you know what you were getting yourself into?
Yes, I did. I mean, I've been 6 years in Keys. I spent 8.5 years on Douglas Council. And on Douglas Council, I was chairman for a lot of that time of the Housing Committee. So although Timwood, obviously very different scale to local authority, I had some of the challenging jobs around Douglas Council as well. I went into politics to try and actually help people, to try and make their lives better. I didn't go into politics for titles such as minister and so on. And I was delighted when the people of Douglas North put their trust in me and then put their trust in me again last year. And I'm here to try and help ensure that we can make our island as best as it can be.
OK, well, talking about Douglas, I mean, you're Douglas North MHK. How are things going? How do you think Douglas now has developed? Is it going well? What about the promenade? Is that to your satisfaction?
The promenade scheme's an interesting one. I think it's the same as, I'm pretty much the same as everyone else. There's certain bits I love, there's certain bits I'm a bit dubious on.
Which bits?
The roundels, I must say, is one of the ones, even although they seem to now be working. I've always been a bit dubious about that and why it wasn't the original design of a built-up roundabout. I understand there was, you know, issues around the budget. There was also issues around timing and delays. But I still, in the back of my mind, feel they should have actually been proper roundabouts.
So let's just clarify that. The roundels were the responsibility of the DOI, weren't they?
That's right.
Not Douglas Council.
No. In terms of Douglas Council, I believe the lighting scheme that they're doing down there has been going well. Perhaps I think they need maybe a bit more lighting on the pavement side and the seaward side. But the, you know, Douglas Council has done an awful lot to try and bring the town up over the last few years. I think there's an awful lot more work to be done, but that can only work if the local authority works with government and government works with the local authority. It's only by working hand in hand for the betterment of the town that it'll actually get anywhere.
Well, let's go to the lines again. And we've got David, I think, on line one. Good afternoon, David.
Hello there. Hiya. Hello, David.
Hello, David.
Go ahead, David. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I don't know whether you'd be able to answer these questions, David, but it's about the Pullrose Power Station coming to life expectancy
yes.
in 2030. Now, from inside government, progress has been made? Have we identified a site for the new power station, or has planning been asked? Do we know what the new power station is going to be run on? Because even if you decided on Monday to build it, you need planning. It would take probably 4 years to build. That's providing that the power station that we've got now doesn't break down in the next 7 years.
Right. Well, my understanding, David, is it's not the site that actually needs to be changed. It's the turbines. So the gas turbines is what comes to end of life in 2031. So as far as I'm aware, there's no plans to relocate the power station. It would be having to switch the turbines out. Now, even so, what you actually say is right. You know, it's not something you can plan in 12 months. You've got to have a plan beforehand. I can only speak from the point when I left government, and that was there was conversations ongoing as to how we actually replace them. What type of mix needs to be done, because one of the things I'm very keen on, and I've said all along, it was in my manifesto at the election, is I think we need to be pushing much more the green technology. The green technology's come on a long way in the last 5 years, and we need to be ensuring that our power plant is basically powered mainly from renewable energy.
Okay, that makes sense. But the talking of green energy, I had a look on the website yesterday for electric charging points around the island, and most of them are very low kilowatts. There's only one on the island that's a fast charger. I mean, if we're going green, why have we only got one fast charger at the sea terminal?
Yeah, and that's something that does need to change. I know there's commitments from DOI. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head now how many charging points a year was the commitment when Mr. Baker was minister, and that they were going to put in each year. I don't know if it was about 50 or 60, I think, off the top of my head, but I'd have to go back and check. But that's something that we will really have to drive forward with as well, is charging points. But what we have to do as well is keep an eye on the technology, because one of the things I've always said when it comes to green technology is, for those of us of a certain age, I've always invoked the thing about VHS and Betamax, where one thought one was going to take off and then it ended up being the other. And I know there's a lot of stuff going on with hydrogen at the moment, and what we've got to be very careful of is we don't throw everything into electric to then find that the technology of the future is actually hydrogen. So we need to actually make sure we are monitoring what way it's going, and we don't put all our eggs in one basket.
David.
Yes. We've just redeveloped the prom, and we spent, I don't know the cost of the prom, but on the prom by Loch Promenade, you put two or three charging points, but only very low kilowatt output, and yet you've only allowing people to park there for 2 hours. It just contradicts itself. If you've got an electric charger and your battery's running out, how on earth are you going to charge it in 2 hours if it's not a fast charger?
Yeah, I know, I agree. I don't disagree with you at all in regards to that. And I think one of the important things going forward is that we ensure across the whole of government that all policies are joined up. And I think, I think the problem is sometimes, and I've said this about the whole setup of government with the departments and the way they currently operate, that it develops silo mentality. And I think what's important is you've got the highways division working hand in hand with those who are putting in the green technology to ensure that the policies are aligned. And we need to make sure we do that across the whole of government, that our policies are actually working in tandem, not actually contradicting one another.
Yeah. Would we not be better on the island with something like Alaman PLC and do away with all these different departments that we've got? People overseeing people, overseeing people, overseeing people. Alaman PLC, if you're in charge of the hospital, you've got a hospital background. If you're in charge of education, you've come from 30 years of a very high profile education post.
I don't always think having someone who's actually come from that background necessarily is always a good thing. The way I've always viewed it, and it's the same in the private sector as well, is sometimes having someone who's coming completely fresh actually gives you new ideas and also gives you a different perspective on it. So, for instance, take the example when I went into health and social care, I haven't got a medical qualification anywhere, and you certainly wouldn't want to find me ready with a scalpel to do your operation if you went up to Nobles. But what happened was, when I came into the department, I had to learn about various things, and I asked a load of questions that I perhaps thought myself were stupid questions. But as a result of that, things that came out was people saying, well, actually, we hadn't thought about that. We hadn't considered that. So I think sometimes if you've got people who are too close to something, then they don't necessarily see the full picture. But certainly the setup of government, I've always believed it should be Alaman government should be one single legal entity, and that the departments, although they would still exist, actually exist as part of that entity, which means that all the departments are working together. And some things, I had a question on this in House of Keys this week, such as capital projects, should be centralised, because the department's trying to run very, very complicated and expensive capital projects just doesn't work, to my mind, on their own. It needs to be centralised with proper experience.
So, David, does that satisfy your questions?
It does indeed.
Okay.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you.
Many thanks. We appreciate your comments. Thank you. Cheers. Bye. Well, he had a point. Is there too much government on the island? Too much bureaucracy?
Well, that's one of the reasons I have always favoured single legal entity, because I think once you've got a single entity of government, there's an awful lot of things that are duplicated in multiple departments that I think you could get rid of. Capital projects, again, being an example, where that could actually go into a central unit that can call on specialist resources, because no two capital projects are necessarily the same. So if you're dealing with the promenade or if you're dealing with the landing stage, that's two very different types of expertise potentially needed. And I think a centralised capital project unit will have much more opportunity to actually pull in resource that's specialised in that area than an individual department can.
What about the MHKs themselves? Shall we get rid of a few?
The MHKs themselves, I actually think the 24 works. I'll be controversial, though, in the fact that, well, it's not controversial because I've said it publicly many times, I believe the number on Legislative Council could be reduced. I've said in my manifestos before that there's 8 appointed MLCs at the moment. I believe that number could go down to 5 or 6. Mrs. Corlett brought actually a motion to Tynwald that was then adjourned, which I was supporting a couple of years ago, to see that reduction. So I think there is, I think what the problem is when you're a small jurisdiction, if you reduce down the number too far, you reduce the political scrutiny and you end up with a higher percentage of members involved in government, which then leaves you less for the scrutiny side.
But there is a bit of an overlap, isn't there, between the MHKs and the work the commissioners do?
There is, and that's a very good point, Barry, because you bring me very nicely onto a topic of which I've got coming to the July Tynwald for a general debate on local authority reform. I've always been quite clear on this. There should be 5 local authorities around the island, is my point of view: North, South, East, West, and Douglas. And basically, there should be statutory responsibilities for local authorities laid down in law of what's the responsibility of a local authority. They undertake those statutory responsibilities. They have democratic accountability for them. And government then basically controls what is a national arena. I'll repeat something I said many years ago, which is we've got to be one of few governments in the world that is playing with car parks. We are a government that runs car parks. That is normally a local authority function in even small jurisdictions that you go to, and it should be here on the island as well.
OK, we're going to take a very brief break. We'll be back in just a few moments with David Ashford, MHK.
The Man in Line, brought to you by netzeromatrix.com, helping Isle of Man companies and citizens to understand net zero targets and a green future.
And today we're with David Ashford, MHK, in the studio. Now, David, I think we'll go to a couple of our phone calls now. We've got some very eager callers here on line one, I think, is Nigel. Good afternoon, Nigel. Are you there?
I think you've got Dewan.
It's Dewan. You have to excuse me. This is my first time on this job, you know.
I'll go as an alias. It's fine. Everyone else goes as an alias. I'll go as an alias. I'll be Nigel. It'll be fine.
Well, go on, Dewan. My apologies to Nigel, who's on the other line, right? So, Dewan, the floor is yours.
Hang on a bit, Nigel. David, how are you?
Very well, Nigel / Dewan. How are you?
Yeah. I'm living an alter ego by the sounds of it. David, I know I've given you a hard time for the last few years, among with other people. But you know what? In all fairness, if someone's going to coerce me into taking experimental vaccines and lock me out of the island that I was born on, then I'm going to give anyone a hard time. It's not just you. Like you said, you took the position up, and you're steering the helm, so you're going to get the crux of it. The question I ask is, talking about the case that's come up recently and how you've stood down, is about questioning the information that you get. And I've said this for the last two and a half years now on various points, is actually questioning the information that you get. And it's now coming out with different things, that information that is received, and you're getting the back end of this, it's not being correct information that you've been given. And this has been my point for a lot of stuff that's gone on, is you're following, the government follows agendas. And I know you said you're not a medical person, you weren't a medical person when you were in that position, so you trust other people. And my point is, I think a lot more questioning needs to be given by ministers and MHKs to the information that they're getting, and whether it's relevant and whether it's honest and truthful for the benefit of the people of the island. I was talking to an MHK last week who actually asked for a hard hat and went up on a roof to inspect it because he wanted to challenge the people who were doing it and ask them questions before money was issued to them. And that's the type of MHK that I want representing me, is someone who's actually going to ask awkward questions and not go along with agendas and world agendas, which kind of is going in a really weird place at the moment around the world. And like I've said before, I think the Isle of Man has got the uniqueness to stay away from a lot of the rubbish that's going to happen. But that's down to you guys who are elected on behalf of the people to represent the people and actually, you know, have a mind of your own rather than, you know, the all the information that you've been given.
Yeah, I know, I fully agree, and it's absolutely, scrutiny is absolutely important. I mean, as a minister, I can say, I can't speak obviously about the current case because of the sub judice, but what I can say in general is, as a minister, I did always challenge back. Other political members who served with me in the department know that I was quite challenging as a minister in terms of information that came our way. But there does come a point, even as a politician, where you have to accept the information that you're being given. Because if you spend your entire life challenging everything that comes back, and you keep getting the same answers back, eventually you won't get anywhere because you'll spend your entire time challenging and delving down into the detail rather than actually getting anything done. But I, you know, as a minister, I did challenge quite considerably information, not just when I was health minister, but also treasury minister. But ultimately, when you've got professionals telling you something, you know, and it's their area of expertise, there is a point, as there is in any walk of life, even out in the private sector, where you have to accept that advice, particularly if it's coming from multiple sources.
Well, on the same token, then you actually have to accept the fact that you're going to put your signature to that.
Yes, so you do.
You're the one who's next in the noose.
I fully agree. And I mean, ultimately, the buck does stop with the minister for a department. Even if they've not necessarily, I've said this before, even if they've not necessarily been involved in a decision, the ultimate responsibility is the minister. They are the front face of the department. They are the political representative. They are, as you say, the person who's been voted in to represent the people of the island. So at the end of the day, as I've said previously, you know, it's not an argument of over whether a minister has done anything right or wrong sometimes. It's actually simply the fact that something has gone wrong and the minister has to accept they are the figurehead of the department and take responsibility for that.
So how much teeth has MHKs actually got and the Council of Ministers? Because you seem to be following, as England progresses or further down the line with the powers that be of progressing with different things, the Isle of Man government just seems to follow in tow with most of anything that it's told to do. So, you know, we've got 24 members there. I mean, there's arguments for and against of how many people there should be there. You talk to people like Betty, who said there's far too many government people. How much teeth have you actually got to make a difference? How much agendas of other people's do you follow without saying, hold on, this is the Isle of Man, no, we're not going to do that?
Personally, I would actually say quite a lot. We have quite a lot of autonomy. In relation to certain taxes, we have shared agreements with the UK, so things like fuel duty, for instance, as part of our customs agreements, we mirror what the UK does there. But in terms of day-to-day policy on the island, the government is effectively autonomous. So if we decided to go a different route, as long as it doesn't impact on, for instance, our freedom of travel into the UK or elsewhere, the government actually has quite a bit of leeway and can actually pursue whatever policies it wishes. Sometimes the policy across the water might be the right policy, but ultimately the decision is the MHKs. And I've never gone with this whole thing of, oh, well, the MHKs have had to do that because across the water. My personal view as an MHK is if I vote for a policy, it's because I believe the policy is right and I have to stand up and explain why I think that's right. If I vote against something equally, I've got to say why I believe it's wrong. The decisions are mine and I have to stand by those decisions. And I think that's the same for all of my MHK colleagues.
OK, June, I think we have to move on now.
Cheers, Barry.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Have a good day. Well, just before we go on to our next caller, here's one from Jill, who didn't want to go on air. It says, How do the MHKs fill their days? What do they actually do during the week? Bearing in mind there are 24 of them and only 85,000 odd people on the island.
Right, so in terms of an MHK's weekend, it's a good chance to get that out there, that it's not just about the parliamentary sittings, which occur once a week. Most members are members of departments, so there is also the departmental work for whatever they've got delegated responsibility for, and also the department boards. There is also, as well, any scrutiny committees that the members may be sitting on. So, for instance, I'm on the Justice, Constitution and Legal Affairs Committee, so there is the workload from that. There is the constituency queries as well. I receive, just to give an example, speaking for myself, I receive roughly around about 30 constituency queries a week to be dealing with as well. And then there is other people who may contact you over other things. There's the research ahead of any questions or issues you may wish to raise. And there's also, so there's an awful lot filling it up. So I can't speak on behalf of all my colleagues, obviously. I can only speak from my personal experience. But it is a full-time job and then plus some.
I think you've made your case. So I hope Jill is happy with that. Well, let's go to our next caller, which is Nigel. I'm so terribly sorry that we didn't come to you. We went to Duan. But anyway, you're on now. The floor is yours, Nigel.
I had a little snooze there, actually.
I'm sorry about that.
And David, you're all right. You can sit back in the chair because I'm not going to throw a health question at you. But it's a tourism question, but it is under health issues. And I'd like your opinion.
Yeah, of course.
I'm going to say. Today and tomorrow, two cruise ships were due. And they've both now been declined. One's in Liverpool now, and I presume they're enjoying their tours around Liverpool. But I'm a tour operator with Albany Tours, and I had a number of passengers that were booked today and tomorrow, and I do Manx products, as people well know, picnic campers, so I've got a fridge full of stuff, salmon and so forth. Now, I understand the reason why the ships has not come in through our good friend Paul Moulton, that put a little tweet last night saying it was under a public health issue regarding restrictions on COVID. Now, I'm not sure which way it is, whether it's the ship has an issue and they've reported to the Isle of Man through the health department they're not coming in, or it's our department because our numbers have gone up, obviously, through the volume of people from TT, and they're saying that it's this side, so they don't want the ships to come in. But on no way over the last 24 hours have I been informed as a tour operator that none of these ships are coming in. If it went to our health department, and this is why I'd like your response, if it went to our health department and they were informed either way, whether they made the decision or the ship did, surely it would be in the interest for the health department to pass it down to the Department of Enterprise and into tourism to make sure people like myself and other people that have got passengers due today to go out on tours, that we should have been informed.
Yeah, just around the situation, first of all, my understanding, I might be corrected later on, but I believe my understanding with both cases was it was the decision of the ships. It wasn't the decision of Isle of Man government or a department of Isle of Man government. I don't know about the second ship, but certainly in relation to the Seven Seas Voyager, which is the one I think was due today, I believe it was down to COVID on the ship, which is why they made the decision not to actually come in. But it was their decision to do. I don't know what time they actually notified anyone that they weren't going to dock, because I think they were supposed to come in, was it 8 a.m. this morning? And they were supposed to be here till 7 in the evening. So I don't know what time they actually made the notification about that. So I don't know if they had several hours notice or whether they made the decision just before they were due to come in. But certainly the main point you're making, which is, shouldn't people be working together? And this ties back to what I was saying earlier in the programme, shouldn't the departments be informing each other? Most definitely. And I would hope that the Department of Health, if they've been informed of something and it's tourism related, would pass it on to the Department for Enterprise to then pass on to the operators, which clearly, for whatever reason, hasn't happened in this. Yeah, because, you know, people, you're quite right, people do prepare. There is cost involved to yourself and the business, quite substantial costs in some cases.
Correct.
And it's absolutely essential that the lines of communication in government aren't a blocker but a facilitator.
Okay, Nigel.
So that's all I know from my information, but certainly my opinion is if a government department has the information, it should go through the proper channels and it should go down to the providers on the ground.
I emailed Tim Krukel last night. I emailed Rob Collister. And on both occasions when they came back to me this morning, none of them had any information of exactly what was happening. So that information wasn't passed on. And now I'm out of pocket, not only with the passengers, but also with the products that I've got here. And sure, other people probably are on the Isle of Man. And I think, like you've said, again, it's lack of communication between the departments and it needs to be sorted out because we've got the rest of the summer to go here. If this happens on a regular basis and we don't get informed, it's not fair on us as the provider that gives these people the tours on the island, and it needs looking at. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you've suffered through 2 years of COVID anyway, and you know the last thing you need is anything else on top. So it is important that the lines of communication are right. So I will undertake to go away and try and find out the answers to that, when the ship's actually notified the government. And why that then wasn't passed on in a timely manner.
Okay, Nigel, we have to move
Thanks
on now.
Indeed. No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Back in
Bye-bye.
Just a few moments.
The Man in Line, brought to you by netzeromatrix.com, your one-stop shop for advice on renewable energy solutions and other green initiatives.
And you're listening to The Man in Line with our guest today, David Ashford, MHK, for Douglas North. Right. Well, before we go on, we've got loads and loads of issues to talk about in the remaining little time we have. We've got one more caller on the line, which we'll go to now, and that is our old friend David. Good afternoon, David.
Hi, David. And hi, David. Just quickly, two questions as far as I'm concerned. The constituency issue is I'm not one of your constituency, but people being on to me all the time, and you know what it is. It's the lane between Williston Crescent and Johnny Watson's Lane. How come after 2 years it hasn't been reinstated? And I'll leave it with you. The Minister Krukel at the time said there was going to be some action with it regarding some legal challenge. So can you just do that for the people who live in North Douglas? The second one is to do with financing. And what is your view now? You're a backbencher. Could you ask some questions on how did the DOI use the money that was earmarked through Treasury and by a vote in Tymold for other services? How does that come about in financial regulations?
So taking the first point first, David, which is the lane, I've been onto this. I've been speaking to residents around it. It's a lane I used to use myself when I was cutting through Williston. It's been sealed off since the refurbishment of the houses. I've been challenging that with DOI as to the fact that, from my point of view, it shouldn't be sealed off. It should still be a footpath through. I have been chasing DOI up in it. I believe there were certain legal issues, and I've given them the benefit of doubt for a few weeks now, but I will be following it up again. So that is on my radar and I am following that up on the constituency side. In relation to the finances, I assume this is in relation to the horse tram tracks and the promenade and the monies that were allocated there. My view hasn't changed as a backbencher compared to when I was actually a minister, which is, you know, the DOI, the money was there for a specific purpose. And it was allocated within, and it seems to have been spent on the general project. My view has always been the same. I believe the horse tram track should run the full length of the promenade, and I would expect that DOI should come back and actually ask if they need further monies to get it completed. It should not be an excuse for not completing it.
Great. Thanks for that. I'll see you again. Bye.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much indeed, David. Now, talking of the tram tracks, what about the future? Were those rails actually, are they actually future-proof? Could you run the electric trams on them?
I know in one of the earlier schemes there was plans to put the multifunctional rails in. I'm not sure if they are. Obviously, if you run the current cable trams down, you'd need a cable as well across the promenade in order to do it. In terms of other types of trams, I'm not too sure. I'll be perfectly honest as to whether or not you can. I mean, I think personally, I mean, I was one of the Douglas councillors that voted that the horse trams should go from Douglas
really?
Council. Yes, I was on Douglas Council at the time because of the cost. Government decided to take them on. And I think they are an important tourism attraction. But I think equally, we need to be sure that they're run as efficiently as they are.
Well, yeah, talking of efficiency, I mean, you've got all this infrastructure. I mean, you've got vintage rolling stock, but modern rail lines.
Well,
what a shame.
Well, I think the thing is you've got to use, you talked there about sustainability for the future. You've got to ensure that the rail lines are appropriate for what they're being laid into, etc. Trying to source and the cost of vintage lines.
But those aren't vintage rails, are they? They're
modern
not,
they're
rails.
Modern, and that's what I'm saying. But vintage rails, the cost can be quite astronomical. And I believe the way they're laid as well, if I seem to remember from years ago when I was a Douglas councillor, is slightly different too. So we have got to move with the times with some things, but the important thing is the service itself, and I think the service needs to be as efficient as it possibly can be.
Okay, let's go to the lines again, and Eddie is on the line. Good afternoon.
How are you doing? All right.
Hi,
I'm
Eddie.
Doing fine. I'm sure Mr. Ashford is as well.
Yeah, I got mixed up. I was thinking David was the finance fella, but that's Allinson, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I'm happy to try and answer your question, Eddie.
Yeah, good. Well, I want your opinion, actually. On the radio the other day, I think the item said that the island's finances are good due to very prudent budgets in the past few years. We've come out of it very well. Did you hear him say that, yes?
I did indeed, yes. I heard Alex's interview.
Yeah. Well, my question is, if our finances and everything are so good, why is it that somebody somewhere cannot find the money to look after the Southern Swimming Pool, which has had nothing put onto it for the last 8 years, whereas every other pool has had at least $250,000? So maybe your opinion might just help in one little bit to persuade his finance minister.
Yeah, so in terms of the Southern Swimming Pool, obviously a good portion of it is rate-borne, and there hasn't been an adjustment in the rates, I believe, in relation to the swimming pools for quite a considerable period of time. But one of the things that needs to happen with the swimming pools is they need to be sustainable into the long term. So it's not just about financing it through this year or next year, and Treasury, when I was Minister, has given additional funding to keep them going. Yeah. What we've got to do is get a sustainable model.
Well, can I ask you why you said that? They've got to be sustainable when initially every swimming pool, we all know, it's impossible for it to make a profit.
Well just to be clear, Eddie, by sustainable, I don't necessarily mean break even or make profit. Sustainable means you know the direction of travel of the finances over a period of time. So you have to be able to know what the actual cost is going to be over the next 10-15 years, what investments needed. Sustainable doesn't necessarily mean they're going to make a profit. I don't think the pools will ever be in a position, personally,
it's
my personal opinion, to make that profit. But in terms of the why, and I think that's what we need to get to. So Treasury has given some interim funding to the pools to be able to get them through this financial year while that review is undertaken. So that's the same for all of the pools around the island, including the Southern.
Yeah, well, not long ago, David, the government actually said they would help to keep the fund, they will find the funds to keep the pool open. But seemingly, we have a board who don't want that to happen. They seem to be against it. But all as I'm asking for is we've only had £19,000 put towards the Southern Swimming Pool, whereas every other pool in the island has had money pumped at it left, right and centre. And down here in the south, all we want to do is take a little backward step and keep that pool open and finance it, and the cafe, because the cafe people do multitasking there. They do reception, they do everything. And what we want is to keep it open until something else is in place. That's a dead easy question and a simple request, that's all.
Yeah, and that's what the funding this year is designed to do. The funding Treasury's put in is designed to keep it going while the Department for Education, Sport and Culture undertake a fundamental review of the pools. I'm not going to preempt what that review will actually say, but we'll wait and see what that review says when it comes forward and how we then move forward with the pools.
Right, well, thanks for your opinion, David. Cheers.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks, Eddie. Thanks for calling. Much appreciated. In the little time we've got left, I'm told that the Isle of Man is a very rich land. Is this true?
What do you mean by rich, Barry?
Well, we have lots of money. There's lots of money on the island.
There is some very wealthy companies, some very wealthy individuals. Our GDP is very high. I've never been one of those in favour of using GDP as a measure because there is distortions in there. But we do have a very high GDP.
But very briefly then, why have we got so many potholes? Why do we have difficulty filling so many posts, etc., etc.?
And this is something that has to be sorted out in this administration, because we are a wealthy island, but we are also a low-tax jurisdiction. And there is that imbalance where we want high level of service, public services, but also want to maintain our low tax profile. And there is a tension there. And that's something that this administration is going to have to tackle. I was quite honest about that when I was Treasury Minister. It's going to have to be tackled over the next 4 years and have a public debate around where are this public services pitched and how are those public services paid
because
for.
Because we've got people at the bottom end, you know, on the social housing ladder, or want to even get on it.
And that is precisely why, again, the work that Chris Thomas is doing with the Housing Board is going to be so instrumental. Because, again, if you haven't got housing that people can access cheaply at an appropriate price point, you are not going to encourage the people over and the young families over to work and grow the population that we need to drive the economy in the future.
Do you think we're over generous to some of the wealthier people?
One of the things I've always mentioned, and I mentioned it last time I was a backbencher, was around the income tax cap. That has changed. The previous Treasury Minister, to his credit, took on board the criticisms I was making, and over several budgets did actually change that. I think what we've got to be very careful of as a jurisdiction is that we still encourage people to invest.
David Ashford, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. That's David Ashford, MHK, MBE, our guest on today's Man in Line. And not surprisingly, we've had so many texts and messages, it's been impossible to read them all out on the programme. We've had quite a few phone calls. Well, no, one or two we weren't able to take. As always, though, we will read the messages and we also pass them on to the newsroom. Thanks to Howard Kane, studio producing today, and Andy Wint, if you're listening, do get well soon. After the news, Christy De Haven is here with 1 to 3, followed at 3 by Chris Pearson with the afternoon show. I'm Barry Redfern. I'm back at 5:30 with the roundup of the island's news. Good afternoon.